Hello, I'm Oliver Wong.
And I'm Morgan Rhodes. You're listening to Heat Rocks. Every episode, we invite a guest to join us to talk about a heat rock, you know, hot lava, fire, combustibles. Today, we'll be winding things back to 1972 and a song for you by the finest pop balladeers to ever represent the LBC, a.k.a. Iowa by the Sea, the Carpenters.
No one in the world ever had love as sweet as my love. For nowhere in the world could there be a boy as true as you love.
According to Wikipedia, what if is a hypothetical question that often is used in the context of counterfactual history, alternate history, and uchronia. Whatever. So what if the Richard Carpenter Trio remained just an instrumental band with RC on keys and Karen on skins? What if Karen was like, you know, it's cool. I really do enjoy being just a drummer. What if their demo tape didn't get to Herb Alpert, who signed them to A&M? I don't know. I do know that in 1972, after the flop that was their debut album Offering, the Grammy-winning smash Close to You, and their self-titled John, they released A Song for You, originally meant to be a concept album, the concept that went triple platinum. And though the song didn't drop until after the initial release, Top of the World was a heat rock, a sonic show and tell for the dulcet tones of Karen Carpenter. 13 tracks, soft pop, soft rock, soft on the inside. Whimsical, sanguine, radio-friendly goodness that told us that Richard was actually nice on the keys, Carole King and Paul Williams' pen game was strong, and Karen had vocals. A voice described as not only the stuff of dreams, hauntingly beautiful, and the voice of a lifetime, but also without exception described with reverence as angelic, divine, and God-given, which makes sense to me as a church girl, because Jesus was also a carpenter.
Song for You was the album pick of our guest today, Karen Tongson. She should be familiar to Max Fun listeners as she is part of the Pop Rocket Power Quartet. And when she's not searching out the best karaoke bars around the world, she's a professor at USC. It would be a massive understatement to note that she cares a great deal about the Carpenters, and Karen Carpenter in particular, as she is named after the singer. And this spring, Karen Tongson, our Karen, has published the book Why Karen Carpenter Matters, which appears on the Music Matters book series edited by our previous Heat Rocks guest, Evelyn McDonald, and myself. And I swear to God, this is not a conflict of interest by having her on. Karen Tongson, welcome to Heat Rocks.
Hey, Oliver. Hey, Heat Rockers.
So in picking this, obviously you have a book around this. Obviously the Carpenters are important to you, and I am nowhere near as big of a fan of the Carpenters as I'm sure you are, Karen, but in listening to this album, it instantly, on a Proustian level, triggered this memory of growing up in the early 70s in New England. And even though the group is best known for their connection out in California, of course, they do have their roots in Connecticut. But for me, it was just that I grew up listening to the Carpenters because my parents listened to it. And I was born in 72, just a couple months after this particular album came out. And so I don't know if there's any other group that I remember having a distinct memory of first, if not the Carpenters. And so every time I hear her voice, I hear those arrangements, it just takes me back to my early childhood. What was your earliest memory of the Carpenters?
I have to say that it's highly likely that this was my soundtrack in utero, this album, A Song for You. My biological parents, my mom and my bio dad, were musicians together. And they were young kind of teen musicians who performed in an ensemble called the Circus Band. And the story goes they met in a production of Jesus Christ Superstar. And I was probably conceived around the time of that. But my mom was a huge, both my parents actually were huge Carpenters fans. And I think they always knew that they wanted to name me after Karen. Also, people used to say my mom sounded like Karen. So I can't really say that there is a precise moment that I recognized. I heard the Carpenters, but that they were always part of like my sonic environment. Probably, you know, again, pre-birth, right? So, so I don't have a distinct memory of that at all. The thing that in why Karen Carpenter matters that I kind of dwell on is the idea of this fundamental lack of separation sometimes that we have between the music that is literally kind of shapes who we are, literally like is about who I'm named after, and you know, ourselves. So that's kind of, you know, so I mean, I remember for the first time that I began to accept the Carpenters as something that I wanted to listen to. And I think that that was when I was a kid who just moved from the Philippines to the United States. And it was actually related to a song on A Song for You. It is, of course, Goodbye to Love, which is often credited as being the very first power ballad. And I thought that it would be a kind of seamless transition between listening to Journey, which was popular at that moment, the early 80s when we moved here, and a song like Goodbye to Love. And by the way that the neighbor boys looked at me once I put it on, I realized, okay.
Not cool.
Not cool. There's something here that's still very much bound up with, that's freighted with my past and with my story of immigration, you know.
All the years of useless search have finally reached an end. Loneliness and empty days will be my own friend. From this day, love is forgotten. I'll go on as best I can.
Morgan, were you hardcore bumping the Carpenters growing up?
I'm going to be honest with you, no. But I will say, my parents didn't play the Carpenters growing up. The first experience I had with the Carpenters might have been maybe sixth grade, middle school graduation. We sang We've Only Just Begun. And the reason I remember that was because one of my classmates, who was like a super thug named Billy, he started crying during We've Only Just Begun. And I was so shocked because he was such a bully and that he broke down during this song. And so I said, what's, you know, I nudged him and I was like, are you cool? And he was like, this shit just got to me.
I think that's what always happens with the Carpenters, actually, is this shit just gets to you.
And I was like, I can't believe it. He was like, that it got to me. I was like, no, that you cursing in church, right? But anyway, that was my experience. And so it's just the voice, and we can get into that later.
Yeah,
that, you know, you want to get into the Carpenters as a band, as a group, but you can't get past the voice.
Right.
It's the beginning and it's the end of it for me. So that was my experience.
And when the evening comes, we smile.
Why this album?
I think this album for me is important because of the concept of it, which is kind of, which feels a little bit half-baked when you actually listen to the whole thing. The main concept in it really is that the song, the whole album is bookended by two versions of A Song for You.
With an intermission.
With an, and there is
with
an
a
intermission.
Crazy intermission.
Yeah. Like that, about, you know, that's scatological. We need to go to the bathroom.
Yeah.
Intermission. it also, to me, I think has some elements of maybe a, like it lends itself to an interesting psychoanalytic read of the Carpenters. First thing, A Song for You, I think when you listen to it, obviously post-mortem, after Karen died, it takes on much more significance, especially the eerie reprise at the end. The rest of it in between, I think where you have Richard and the kind of insertions of Richard's virtuosity as a pianist and his story of origin piano picker in the middle of all this amazing, there were six hit singles from this album.
Yeah.
And then you have a song, like a novelty tune, like Piano Picker.
Totally. Yeah.
And just for me, I think it says a lot about the negotiations they were starting to have to make as they were attaining fame and as Karen's voice started to become the center of attention. And I think it is, this album is about them trying to sort out like how to center that voice without losing Richard, who is the kind of primary figure in their familial life for sure, and certainly kind of behind the scenes.
The thing with me with the fact that they named the album after the song A Song for You, which is a song I've always associated with another artist who died way before their time, Donny Hathaway.
Sure.
In fact, I didn't even realize it was actually a Leon Russell original until
right.
I was prepping for this. I'm like, right. Oh, that wasn't Donny's original either. But I feel like Donny has one of the definitive versions of it.
He owns that
right.
song.
Yeah.
And so I always come into any version of A Song for You thinking of Donny and automatically getting a little bit sad. And so the fact that, like, the Carpenters are covering it just only further accentuates the inherent melancholia, as Karen's pointing out here, about that song.
I mean, Donny's was 1971, though, right?
Yeah.
And this one was 72. So his was first, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Prior to this one, yes.
Prior to this
yeah,
one.
Right.
And I took issue to that. Of course, like you, I didn't know about Leon Russell. I mean, the only Leons I check for are Bridges and Ware anyway. So I wasn't really up on Leon Russell. And then he had a song with Dixie. I was like, oh, no, Leon, I don't know. But so I didn't know that. But when I think about Donny Hathaway and I think about this song, it's the time he takes with the song. Mm-hmm. It's by the time he gets to I Know Your Image of Me. It's the background that we know about his mental health and his depression,
yeah.
The Clouds That version. And so it put a lot of pressure for me on Karen's version. It's very Hillsong United,
yeah.
a little gentrified. And
I love that description of the song.
A little bit, you know, so you're just like, oh, okay. And so there's just so much weight on Donny's version. And it sounds like he's talking about something completely different than whatever it is that Karen chose. Yeah. But ballsy to take this on, though.
I know your image of me is what I hope to be. I treated you unkindly, but darling, can't you see?
There's no one more important to me. Darling, can't you please see through me? 'Cause we're alone now and I'm singing this song for you.
I think that one of the legacies of the Carpenters' version of A Song for You is that it's often the kind of locus classicus for any discussions of, like, the fundamental whiteness of the Carpenters, how apparent that is in the arrangement and the phrasing. Because I think that there are many songs in which Karen demonstrates a much more, I don't know, emotionally connected capacity to phrase through the song. And in this one, it's almost as if she's like click-tracked the emotion out of the
yeah,
song,
yeah,
you know? And
yeah.
That's that, to me, that feels like the moment where Richard Carpenter and the kind of the automatization of Karen Carpenter becomes made apparent
yeah,
through that.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, and it reminds me of, gosh, I don't know how many years it was ago, but there was this a car salesman named Pete Ellis.
Oh, yeah, Pete Ellis Dodge.
Pete Ellis Dodge. Yeah. And he would sing that Long Beach Freeway, and the balls would bounce
yeah.
over it. And so in Song for Love, I always see the balls. It just has that, which is very white
yeah.
to me.
Yeah. Firestone exit, Southgate.
No.
That was a jam, though, really. Okay.
That really was.
It was.
Long Beach Freeway, Firestone exit, Southgate.
Pete Ellis Dodge and Jeep Eagle.
Long Beach Freeway, Firestone exit, Southgate.
Now there's more.
I will say, though, that the one thing that redeems the Carpenters' version of A Song for You is just listening to the texture of Karen's voice, to listening to the moments where she's starting to run out of breath, and like you just hear that slight bit of fry come in at the end of each phrase. And that's where I feel like the kind of the purity, the spirit of Karen shines through and like kind of cracks the hard shellac of the arrangement.
Can you talk a little bit about Richard and Karen's relationship, just from the outside looking in, with all due respect to them, it seemed a little creepy.
That is the response.
If I can just say, too, in Karen's book, she writes about how Richard would complain to A&M, why do you keep marketing us like a couple? Because the motifs are always romantic in the cover art. It's like we're brother and sister. So I don't think that necessarily was on him, but I'm going to let the expert take it here.
It's a creep factor, though, yeah?
Well, I think I think there definitely is. I think that that's always been something that even, it's not just a kind of belated response we have as contemporary people to this configuration. Like a radio DJ went as far as to ask, you know, your songs are about incest, right? I mean, they asked them that, like, in, I think, the mid-1970s. Wow. I can't remember exactly which interview it was. I mentioned it in the book. But I think that one of the things that affects their relationship the most is the sense that Richard was supposed to be the talented one, the star, the reason they moved. The Carpenter family moved from New Haven, Connecticut to Southern California. Richard disavows this narrative. He's like, you know, my dad hated the cold weather. We came here for the sunshine. It wasn't just because they were trying to do everything for my career, but that's pretty much how it was. And Karen was the kind of trailing sibling. And she, you know, she actually hated the idea of moving from behind the drum. She wanted to be a drummer. She wasn't a singer who drummed, but a drummer who sang. And I think what ended up happening is, as Karen's voice, which eventually started to emerge from these other configurations, like you mentioned in the intro, the Dick Carpenter Trio, she'd occasionally sing a few songs. Then they had a kind of choral experiment called Spectrum, where she sang double lead with another girl. At some point, the low voice was discovered, that low alto voice. Mm-hmm. And it kind of flipped all the expectations in the family. And I think that tension gets read there. I think that there's a kind of willfulness in pushing Richard to the front. Because usually when a band becomes famous and a lead singer becomes really prominent, that lead singer starts to, you know, be pushed to the front and become the center of attention more. But for the Carpenters, it was always going to have to be the both of them. They were always, it was always going to be this kind of either weird twinning with like some strange perverse connotations or what have you. But Richard was never going to be receding into the background, right? Mm-hmm. He would always have to be front and center in the way that they were marketed together. So, I mean, I guess that results to a certain extent in the creep factor, but I also do think it's around it has something to do with the style, that squareness, that, you know,
yeah,
Richard Carpenter arrangement style.
Yeah.
That is at once the thing that makes the Carpenters sound so indelible and also the thing that I think pushes other people away from it.
Yeah. The arrangements, I mean, let's shout Richard out for background vocals and stuff too, because the way they're layered together really pretty, but it is a little bit creepy. And if I can be petty, the aesthetic too, he had the ill bowl cut, which made him look a little bit, you know.
It was the 70s in his defense.
It was.
A lot of people had bad haircuts.
They did, but some people look cool with that. Richard wasn't looking cool with it. You know what I mean? But I feel like he tried to flex his muscle on this album with songs like Piano Picker, which I judged the first time I heard it, because the first verse he's saying, you know, people always ask me why I play so fine. And I was like, well, hell, there's no shortage of confidence in the Carpenter camp. And then when I listen to the song in its entirety, it sounds like he's thanking God for the piano that gave him a career, that pulled him out of being a geek. He wasn't playing football with the boys, like he said. And look at how far he's come, which it sounds like he's saying, which is like, I'm still in this. She's got the velvet voice. I've got the keys.
Yeah.
And we go together. That's it.
That's it. Yeah, exactly. I didn't have any girlfriends, but I was banging on the keys.
Like, also creepy.
Exactly. I'm just
keep
like,
it real, Karen. Yeah. You know how that sounds.
Oh, yeah, exactly. Yes, of course. It's sort of a nudge, nudge, wink, wink.
Guess I'm really very lucky that I've got this thing to play, 'cause it can really make me feel good even when it's starting
rain. I have to say that that signature choral vocal sound, that overdubbing, that is just like that wall of harmony, is something that, obviously Les Paul and Mary Ford influenced, you know, Richard's experiments in overdubbing, especially in the studio. But I describe it in the book as the infinite redoubling of sameness. And that there's something that is a kind of not exogamous about that. You know, that there's, it lacks an exogamy like this. You know, before they used to harmonize with other people, and now they could just reproduce within themselves, and just the two of them together, like this whole choral range. Yeah. And that I think, again, accounts for that hint of creepiness you said, because it's just them.
And it's also very haunting. You know, one of my dreams as a music supervisor is I would love to music supervise a horror movie. And every time I've thought about that, I've always thought I've wanted to place Karen Carpenter. Because there is a scary, haunting thing that you see. You know, I would, you know, I'm not going to give it away in case a music supervisor is listening. Listen, you got to beat me to this game yourself. But I've always thought that there's something creepy and haunting about that that would lend itself to a horror film. Not to put it in anything romantic, not to put, you know, close to you. I think it makes for a good, part of that is because of the overdubbing that you speak. It's a little spooky.
It's pretty,
but it's spooky.
In a crystal lullaby. Sometimes when I
it's very intimate.
Yeah.
It's intimate, and the intimacy almost seems inappropriate sometimes.
Especially when it's your brother.
Yeah.
When your brother's backing you up, you're like, wait a minute.
I mean, there have been many Family fans that have done that, but I do think it is just the kind of airtightness.
Right.
It's the airtightness, too. It's not just the overdubbing itself. There's a certain way that it's vacuum sealed.
Yeah.
Not the Osmonds.
Right. I think the Osmonds, it had more to do with how they dressed. There's something about the visual twinning that creeped people out. But vocally, that never necessarily came into play. But I think with the Carpenters, it definitely has to do with the sound of it.
Yes.
And along these lines, if you don't mind a really bad pun here, because we've been talking about her voice. Karen, can you get into a little bit about why Karen Carpenter's voice matters?
Morgan opened with a lot of amazing quotes about Karen's voice. One of my favorites is Dionne Warwick talking about Karen's voice, saying it was like the sound of smoking wood. And, you know, it has this kind of smolder to it. I think that the voice was unique because it was such a rich contralto voice that could veer into the tenor range, but that could also then soar like a little, like kind of beyond what you would expect from a normal alto range.
Yeah.
And there's something also about the timbre that feels incredibly difficult to replicate because it's so chesty. It's so like in the chest in a way that, I mean, it's just reverberating from her whole body. And at the same time, it's so incredibly placid.
Yeah.
And you know, that's why I love, like I said, hearing the occasional hitches and rasps and tiny bits of fry that sometimes, and she also is a master at the microphone. That's another aspect of closeness that she worked and used and knew how to use a microphone to enhance like the most resonant aspects of her voice. So I think that that's why it matters. And in many respects, I've said it's inimitable. And at the same time, there's so many people who have been clocked as people having as singers who have similar voices. But no one's going to exactly get that tone, you know.
It's funny because, and I think this goes back to something that a recurring theme in what we've been talking about, which is the relationship or the connection we have between the Carpenters and whiteness. And I think I'm certainly not going to be the first person to ever describe Karen Carpenter's voice as being almost the platonic ideal of being anodyne in a way, except, I mean, which means it's inoffensive, but that doesn't mean it's lacking in character. And I think you're pointing out there's something so singular about the voice, the resonance of it, as you're pointing out, that, and maybe it's because, as I was saying during my intro, that I associate her voice so much with my childhood, and it just takes me back there in that instant moment. And there has to be all these layers of qualities. So even if it is an inoffensive voice in a certain way, it is not a voice remotely lacking in character.
Yeah. Actually, like Morris Kaplan, the musicologist, wrote a chapter about Karen Carpenter in his book on kind of sentimental music and talked about her voice as being a kind of wet maternal ooze, which I think that might like.
Christian, open this door. It's getting hot in here.
Which might link to some of those, again, like childhood memories.
Sure.
Right. But there is a character to it.
Yeah.
Certainly. And I think that, I mean, I've heard people try to capture that, and it's also in the way she enunciates her vowels.
Yes.
And that's linked to, again, a kind of aesthetic that's linked to whiteness, because as their choral director from Long Beach State said, the Carpenters use different vowel sounds, including one that captures a Disneyland smile.
Yeah. The way she says strong, it's like strong.
Yeah.
And that I was like, wait, what? it was just a completely different sound. And I was like, where did that come from? But also, too, and I want to bring up the song I Won't Last a Day, because I don't want to make comparisons. I don't think that that's fair. But I grew up listening to the Diana Ross version of I Won't Last a Day. The one thing that's different is the enunciation of words between Karen and Diana. Obviously, there's no comparison in the voice. But the way that she says, I won't last a day, the sound of those words coming out of Karen's voice, Karen's mouth and Diana's are completely different.
I've found the best when there's no getting over that rainbow. When my smallest of dreams won't come true.
It's those extra runs.
It's the use of melisma. It's like diverting from the melodic line slightly, even though she's actually pretty much on beat here.
Yep.
There's not like a lot of rubato happening in that chorus. I think that the one thing that Karen does is that she can elongate certain vowels, but she doesn't do runs in the same way.
Mm-mm.
And that's one of the things that, you know, that also I think makes their version of a song for you like feel bereft, makes us feel bereft when we listen to it, is the absence of those beautiful Donny Hathaway runs.
Yeah.
So and I think that that's maybe one of the reasons that I think when we think of music without runs or music that's performed straight, we attribute those values to a certain kind of whiteness, right? It also has to do with the way some of the diphthongs are pronounced in the actual verse.
It's nice to know that there's someone I can turn to who will always care.
You know, no, like she sings that no part in a way that is supposed to be most advantageous for the most resonance in the upper part of the palate versus like just kind of singing it to fit seamlessly with one's own phrasing to a certain extent. So I think that choral training, I think, comes out in those moments vocally where, you know, with Diana Ross, it's a different vibe. It's a different kind of vocal training.
Very different.
I also think this is the first time the word diphthong has been used on the show. So
shout out to Karen right
Shout
now.
Shout out to diphthong.
Diphthong, 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 diphthong.
And on that note, we will be back with more of our conversation with Pop Rocket co-host and USC professor Karen Tongson, talking about the Carpenters' 1972 smash album, A Song for You. After this brief word from some of our other Max Fun podcasts, keep it locked.
The Greatest Generation is a Star Trek podcast that destigmatizes the very idea of having a Star Trek podcast.
We're Ben and Adam, the hosts of The Greatest Generation, and the technology we've developed is that nobody knows what you're playing in your earbuds.
You know, with legalization, it's easier than ever to find out what's in your buds. But we suggest that you legally find The Greatest Generation wherever you download your podcasts.
We'll send it to you in a discreet, unmarked package. And nobody has to know but us.
That's The Greatest Generation, the Star Trek podcast that you didn't know you needed, yet makes you feel like you belong.
Dead Pilot Society brings you exclusive readings of comedy pilots that were never made, featuring actors like Patton Oswalt.
So the vampire from the future sleeps in the dude's studio during the day, and they hunt monsters at night. It's Blade meets the Odd Couple.
Adam Scott and Jane Levy.
Come on, Corey. She's too serious, too businessy. She doesn't know the hokey pokey.
Well, she'll learn what it's all about.
Busy Phillips and Dave Koechner.
Baby, this is family.
My Uncle Tell, who showed his wiener to Cinderella at Disneyland, is family. Do you want him staying with us?
He did stay with us for 3 months.
And he was a delight.
A new pilot every month, only on Dead Pilot Society for maximum fun.
We are back on Heat Rocks talking with Karen Tongson about the Carpenters, A Song for You.
I just want to bring things briefly back to Richard. Not that we haven't been talking enough about him already, but it does feel like he, in our collective memory of the Carpenters, right, he is always the Garfunkel to Karen Simon, the Oates to her Hall, if you will. I guess the question here is, does Richard Carpenter matter? And I should note that I'm torn on this question because while I do enjoy what I think is one of the sleeper tracks on this LP, which is his instrumental song, Flat Baroque.
Flat Baroque.
We've talked about Piano Picker already, but when that song comes on afterwards, it kind of ruins whatever joy I might have felt towards Flat Baroque, because I just find Piano Picker to be an odd and corny song, which is a term that gets thrown at the Carpenters a lot. So let's just give Richard like a quick minute here in terms of his due, assuming he deserves it.
Richard absolutely deserves it. Richard absolutely is the arranger who figured out the best way to showcase that part of Karen's range. Mm. Richard also, as much as I think that there was certainly some sibling rivalry involved once she became the focus of the Carpenters,
yeah,
he continued to understand that that was, like he was very, very smart about, again, like showcasing her voice, about creating that signature sound that is the Carpenters. In fact, when Karen recorded her solo album that didn't actually end up coming out until she died, after she died, as fans clamored for it, Richard and Karen had a tremendous row over this whole situation because he at once accused Karen of stealing the Carpenters sound, which, first of all, is there a Carpenter sound without Karen's voice?
Yeah, right.
And he said that the keys were too high for her, and that also he made her swear before she recorded the solo album, Don't Do Disco. And in his mind, she did disco. The way I interpret that in the book actually is around a kind of racial anxiety Richard has about, in much the same way that their mentor Frank Pooler at Long Beach State didn't start really incorporating black music into the choir's repertoire until certain black students approached him about it. Like he said something like, you know, spirituals, I don't understand, they feel alien to me or whatever. This is Frank Pooler. Richard Carpenter, I think, though he may not have explicitly addressed this or phrased it in this way, had a certain, like he had an aversion to certain kind of urban genres, so-called urban genres. Mm. And Karen Carpenter's solo album dabbled with some of those urban genres and with, you know, Quiet Storm and other things. But that album also is not a terrific album, right? So there's something about, like, they're both a little bit right in terms of understanding each other. But like, the system was so closed, it would have been wonderful to see what would have happened if organically over the course of time that system had opened in a way. So I do think, I mean, yes, Richard gets his due for everything that the Carpenter, for that Carpenter's sound.
Right.
But, you know, that Carpenter's sound wouldn't have been immortal.
Sure.
Were it not for Karen's voice.
So if I understand what you're saying, did Richard create the sound and then Karen performed it, or did they both create the sound? Who do you credit for really creating that sound?
I think that Richard created the sound. He was an excellent arranger. He was an okay composer, an excellent arranger. And I think that he was really canny and savvy about producing pop music and pop music that would hit a broad spectrum of fans. Karen was a raw talent in many respects, and it kind of emerged, like her talent unfolded naturally in these different settings, first on the drums and then as she started singing, and the more and more she started singing lower in her range, and the more and more Richard started discovering that, he started writing music or arranging music for that range to showcase that. Mm. So I don't even know that we would discover the so-called low voice were it not for his ability then to arrange for her in the appropriate way. Have either of you listened to the isolated tracks of just her voice? I'd mostly just like to hear you to respond to what you hear, because I've listened to these a lot, but like, what does it feel like to listen to it with Richard stripped out of it?
Right.
Talking to myself and feeling old,
Sometimes I'd like to quit. Nothing ever seems to fit. Hanging around, nothing to do but frown. Rainy days and Mondays always get me down.
Mm. I really hear the intimacy with the microphone yeah. that Karen was talking about earlier, the way in which she understands, you know, distance to the mic, what the amplification does, how to use her voice to take advantage of those things. You really hear that come through?
I hear a little sadness. I hear it not all popped out by Richard and his bowl cut and the Sunshine Band. I hear Karen being like, these days get me down. And the little bit of scratch and rasp in her voice that isn't cleaned up and made pristine when her brother gets involved.
Yeah.
So, wow.
Yeah.
I was going to ask about Goodbye to Love. Because you talked about it being one of the beginnings of the power ballad. And when I was listening to that in prep for the chat, I mean, shout out to Tony Peluso on the fuzz and all that.
Yes.
But all I could think about was Chicago and some of those songs, Hard Habit to Break and I'm Sorry. Because there's always a moment where you're like, oh, here comes the fuzz.
Yeah.
And when it does, you know, this is about to go to higher heights. And that's just what happened on Goodbye to Love.
I'd say goodbye to love. There are no tomorrows for this heart of mine. Surely time will lose these bitter memories and I'll find.
It's just you feel like the stakes are being raised melodically, and so it's just about to be big. And I just remember hearing all those 80s ballads, and I'd be like, oh man, this is when Peter Cetera is about to.
Yeah, he's gonna rip that shirt off.
That's it. But it was always the fuzz that preceded that. So was Tony Peluso like the architect of this or what?
Yeah. Well, first of all, also the clip that we just listened to with the strings.
Yeah.
The strings and fuzz guitar, that is like Chicago pulled that from the Carpenters playbook from Goodbye to Love, like completely. But actually the architect of that sound was Richard Carpenter.
Wow.
And he said, you know what? I want you to play this, like, you know, completely like raucous, like fuzz guitar solo in the middle of this ballad. And Tony Peluso himself, when he first started laying down the tracks, like kept holding back and doing, you know, slightly more sedate little guitar noodling riffs. And Richard's like, no, really, I want a hard rock solo in the middle of this song. Mm. And Tony's like, okay, you're going to get what you want. Here it is.
I'm really glad that we played this particular segment because we've been starting to ask our guests if they have a favorite moment off the album. And the moment where the fuzz guitar drops in here was my pick because it's unexpected. And it really, it should feel dissonant on some level only because of what we're used to with the Carpenters, but maybe because I've heard the song so many times. And this definitely charts in like my top five all time, you know, favorite Carpenter songs. It sounds completely natural. And I don't know if that's familiarity, but there is still that element of surprise where it shouldn't work, but it completely works. Is this one of your favorite moments?
Being reared on bands like Journey and Heart, like it sounds like a completely natural thing to have happen in a song. And so I always try to place myself in the mind of someone who's heard this song for the first time. My favorite part, it happens the very first moment that the guitar solo comes in and Karen's voice returns.
Mm.
And it returns with such unflappable, like, placidity to it. It's like, you know, it's like soaring guitar. And she's like,
what lies in the future is a mystery to us all. No one can predict the wheel of fortune as it falls.
It's just sort of like, this didn't bother you at all. You've just come back.
Right.
And you're completely, this still the same Karen. You're completely, you know, like, so chill. And I love that contrast. And to me, that's what makes this song pretty incredible. Because it's not that Peter Cetera moment it's like, wanna have you near me? You know, and it just like goes back to this complete, it's like, it's so serene.
Right. Right. And after all that fuzz, all those bells and whistles, she's like, whatever, I'm gonna glide in there though.
Yeah, that's my favorite part.
My favorite moment is Road Ode, because I think Karen belts on that thing in a way that I wasn't really expecting. I mean, it's soft rock, but it's cinematic to me. And then it's like, Karen's just like, I'm going for it. And that's, to me, a non-restrained Karen. And I just was like, sing, Karen, when I was listening to
sing, Karen, sing. Oh,
shouting how they love the show. Just keep on wearing a smile. The countless times and places lead me back. Please take me back.
So, Karen, what is your fire track off of this album?
It's I Won't Last a Day Without You.
So many times when the city seems to be without a friendly face, a lonely place. It's nice to know that you'll be there if I...
She's so good with Paul Williams songs, you know? I mean, like, We've Only Just Begun. She's really great with Paul Williams songs. And I don't know what... It's a Carpenter's track that everybody knows, but it's like not as many people sort of refer to as one of the great
tracks. It's not
tracks.
Hit,
it's not. Yeah, it's not. Yeah. But And I love her weird pronunciations in it, you know, without you, you know, like there's something about that where she sits on that, those pronunciations that to me are like, that's Karen Carpenter.
Yeah.
Those are my childhood memories. It's like sitting on that long note. And she sits on you for such a long time. Anyway.
How about you, Morgan? What's your fire track off of here?
I mean, I'm not going to front. I love Top of the World.
See, we have not yet talked about the biggest hit off of here.
Yeah, and I love Top of the World.
Yeah.
Top of the World came into my mind about 2 years ago. I was at the Soho House, and I was waiting for someone. It was a beautiful day, and I happened to look out of the window. And usually when I post on Instagram, I do the hashtag soundtrack for the frame. And what I thought about in the moment was Top of the World. And I was like, this isn't cool.
No.
Do you want to put this on your Instagram? But I had to go. Because many of my friends are millennials and they're going to be like, wait, who? You know, no shade, Christian. But in that moment, that was all that I could think of. And I could hear Karen's voice just so strong. And I fell in love with that song all over again. I know it was probably the biggest hit on this album, but there's something about it more than We've Only Just Begun. Top of the World is what I will always associate with Karen's voice.
I'm on the top of the world, looking down on creation, and the only explanation I can find is the love that I've found ever since you've been around. Your love's put me at the top of the world.
I hope this does not sound ungenerous, but this song to me just encapsulates 1970s variety show white host, white guest. This is like the whitest song I think I've ever heard recorded. I'm not hating on it, but there is something about it. Maybe it's the little country twang that the song opens with.
Yeah.
But yeah, would love to hear additional thoughts on this one from each of you.
Even Richard didn't think it was going to be a hit, though. Oh. That's why they didn't release it until the album had been out for a whole year. Yeah. And actually...
But he wrote it.
He wrote it, but he was just like, you know, he thought it was one of his funny little novelty numbers experimenting with another genre.
Oh.
But guess who loved it? Japan. And the fact that it went to the top of the charts in Japan, became so popular and was like spreading all throughout that region, eventually kind of bounced back, and they're like, well, maybe we should release this as a single here in the US. And so it was big in Japan and then in Europe and then in the US. It was like boy bands in the 90s, how like, you know, it's like NSYNC became popular in Germany first. Well, you know, the same with Top of the World, basically. And I think that it was also kind of reassuring to some of the older fans who had heard Goodbye to Love and wondered if the Carpenters were, you know, going to like verge off into that decadent rock and roll music. Top of the World was deeply reassuring. Also, one of the most wonderful things about Top of the World is that every time, like, Karen hits her beautiful low sweet spot multiple times leading into the chorus in that song, you know, like the nearest thing to heaven that I've seen, you know, and she just like hits those notes every time we go into the chorus of light fluffiness, and that I totally appreciate about this song.
In the leaves on the trees and the touch of the breeze, there's a pleasing sense of happiness for me.
I'm so surprised that you picked Top of the World, just because for all the reasons that I was saying before, it just seems like the most bubblegum of the tracks on here.
I'm cooler than that.
Yeah.
But I love that song. And it's just that moment, that Instagram moment. And that was all I could think. Looking at that view, looking at, you know, houses and things that I couldn't afford. But I still felt like I was on top of the world. Mm-hmm. And it just reminds me of Karen Carpenter.
Your love's put me at the top of the world.
We ask this of our guests. In your opinion, is a song for you right on time, ahead of its time, or timeless?
It's right on time. I think that, again, I wasn't alive then, but my impression of this period of the early 70s was that it actually was a moment where a lot of artists were trying to kind of sort out their relationship between doing arrangements and covers of other people's songs and also writing their own music. I think this is really the first Carpenters album with multiple original songs, and it produced their first original hits.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that that's why it's pretty much on time. I think it also is in that mode of like vague experimentalism. Mm-hmm. It isn't quite, you know, it fully experimental. It doesn't get to that point where we are in the mid-70s where things start to get much proggier, and even the Carpenters themselves start to get much proggier with calling occupants on interplanetary craft. So I think it's of its moment. I think it's right on time.
If you had to describe a song for you in three words, what would you choose?
I mean, the title practically has three words in it. Okay, in three words. Well, there's four words. Introducing the Power Ballad.
We'll let you make it. You wrote the book.
You know,
four.
Well, does a preposition count?
Yep.
You could just say introducing power ballads. How about that? There you go.
Okay. Introducing power ballads. See, there you go. That's why I need good editors in my life.
Well, on that note, that will do it for this episode of Heat Rocks with our special guest, Karen Tongson. You, of course, can catch her weekly on our sister podcast, Pop Rocket. Karen and Karen's new book is called Why Karen Carpenter Matters, in stores now or soon.
Shout out.
Karen, what else are you working on?
I'm actually working on a book about karaoke right now, a little bit about its history, but also like thinking about it as a metaphor for the way we approach art.
And where can people find you?
People can find me on Twitter at Inland Emperor, on Instagram at Tongsonator, and you can look me up at KarenTongson.org.
Thanks for coming through.
Thanks for having me, both of you.
Salute.
You've been listening to Heat Rocks with me, Oliver Wang, and Morgan Rhodes.
Our theme music is Crown Ones by Thess, one of People Under the Stairs. Shout out to Thess for the hookup.
Heat Rocks is produced by myself and Morgan, alongside Christian Duenas, who also edits, engineers, and does the booking for our shows.
Our senior producer is Laura Swisher, and our executive producer is Jesse Thorne.
We are part of the Maximum Fun family, taping every week live in their studios in the Westlake neighborhood of Los Angeles with a view that'll make you feel like you're on the top of the world.
Hey.
We want to thank all of our 5-star iTunes reviewers. We have one new one, finally. This one comes from Jimmy Ether, who said that this has quickly become his favorite music podcast. It's almost better listening to smart people talk about music than listening to the music. Mm. The almost being, I think, the key operative word there. But Jimmy Ether, thank you so much for that. And I know we say this every week, my friends, But seriously, your reviews are a big way in which our show grows and finds new audiences. So if you do have some time, please consider leaving us a review. It is a huge, huge help.
We also want to shout out our social media fans and family out there, including the following folks. We want to thank E.A. Gordon. His Twitter handle is M-dashes. Love that. We want to shout out also Jason Brocardo, who gave us a great suggestion for our next sample show. We want to shout out Kevin Zapp. And I hope it's Zapp like the Zapp Band, because I just love that. I love the Zapp Band. I want to shout out Dante Cargo. Also want to shout out Patrick Miller, Andrew Mullen. We want to shout out, Jacoby81. We also want to shout out Chris Albrecht, that had good things to say about the live show that Oliver Wong did with Chris Melanfi out there in Seattle. We also want to shout out B. Beeman, that gave us some love from his time here. We also want to shout out Lance W., who has given me some support about my love for New Jack Swing. We do so appreciate the Tweezies and the Retweezies. Good to see you, Oliver.
Good to see you too, Morgan. And before we get up out of here, one last thing. Here is a teaser for next week's episode, which features Los Angeles writer and journalist R.J. Smith talking to me about James Blood Ulmer's Odyssey.
Well, first of all, I want to say that I think there are so many hooks in this music. And I really think that they're coming at you all the time. And it's not, they're coming from angles and in places in the music where you're not used to hearing them, but there's so many coming all the time. But okay, then they're throwing them out and picking up a new one, or they're picking up the one that that drummer played, and so they're passing them around in this freeway, and they're not passing them around on the same part of the measure. You know, it's like there's 12-bar blues, but then there, which is the most common kind of blues, where right, you feel you know what's coming when in a certain way. But the earlier Delta blues players, you know, if it felt good, you'd throw an extra bar in there. So suddenly you've got a 13th bar, or you'd cut a couple off just because it just felt right. And it does feel right when a master's doing it. When John Lee Hooker is playing the blues, you just feel it. But you, if you count it out, you realize, wait a minute, we're not where we're supposed to be in this song. And in a way, that's what this is, too. This is just that kind of gut reaction.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.